Okay, this is 2013 SC 382. May I have the entry of appearances, please?
Good afternoon, Madam. My name is Richard Walls, 11567. This is John L. Pastor, my firm on behalf of the petition.
Thank you, Mr. Walls. And for the respondent, please.
Thank you, Mr. Court. My name is Alan Shafton. My registration number is 9508. Along with me is John Poole.
All right, thank you. Counsel, this is a case which has been set for 1 hour. That means that each side has a half an hour. You'll have to keep track of your own time, please. And then whenever you're ready, we go ahead, Mr. Walks.
Thank you, Your Honor, police, the court, counsel. I would like to reserve 5 minutes in rebuttal. We are here before the court today because of a horrible accident that occurred on about March 4, 2007. And the court is well aware of the accident and the briefs submitted by the parties. A few things I would point out: that Ms. Grove, the plaintiff, is a persistent vegetative state according to the medical records that are provided in this case. And after the dead car, Mr. Martin died as a result of the injuries sustained. The other occupants of the vehicle in that tragic evening were seriously injured, but for the driver, Ms. Angela Reed. Some of the facts that are undisputed in this case are that the vehicle that was involved, in fact, was owned by the respondent, the defendant who played in the case, Jillian Grove. It is also undisputed that Ms. Grove had entrusted her vehicle that evening after the eviction by the hotel to Ms. Angela Reed, who had later been responded to an elevated blood alcohol level. It's undisputed the accident occurred 15 miles from the hotel. It's undisputed that the accident involved the illegally towed set of vehicles on 225 near Parker Road. It's undisputed, among other things, that there were no seatbelts. The record also reflects that at no time during the course of the events leading up to the accident, in the hotel or its employees had any contact with the driver of the vehicle, Angela Reed. There's nothing to support that, and that is what the evidence has been. It is also a fact that Ms. Reed had no contact with nor spoke with him in the hotel herself. This case is here in primarily because we have two court of appeals decisions and a fairly unusual set of events. The petitioner prevailed in a 2-1 decision on or about November 14, 2012, due to circumstances and a motion for reconsideration. That was reversed, and a new opinion was issued on or about March 28, 2013. It is our reading of the briefs of the plaintiff, or I should say of the respondent, that Ms. Grove would have this court fashion a far-reaching, extensive new tort in a case of first impression, which would be inconsistent with the common law, the voluntary intoxication of socially undesirable conduct, and an individual responsibility to refrain from such conduct must be promoted. We read carefully the order of this court regarding the issues to be determined on appeal. The court ordered that we are to brief whether the Court of Appeals erred in holding the hotel has a duty not to evict a guest under the circumstances of this case, and the reason the jury could find a breach of a duty of such duty on the present record, that's one. And two, whether the Court of Appeals erred by failing to apply the Colorado Dram Shop Act when finding that summary judgment based on proximate cause was not warranted. Having read those, we assume that the court was not asking the simple law of whether one can be evicted by a hotel. We assume that the facts of this case, what the court was inquiring, is given certain circumstances in a hotel, or frankly, as we read, any businessman, when there are issues that arise with occupants of the property, real property, whether one has a right to ask someone to leave the property under circumstances where there is not immediate danger outside the property, knowing when you're doing so, you know that the person is physically and mentally unable to take care of themselves once they're evicted from the property. Some of the facts I did not mention in my opening statement was that the Westin did not serve any alcohol in this case. The room itself does have a bar, as most hotels do, in the room, but there's absolutely no record whatsoever that any of that alcohol was used or imbibed. The vehicle itself was never in the possession, custody, or control of the hotel. The record is clear that it was parked in property, on property that was adjacent to the hotel in the Tabor Center. It is not owned or operated by the hotel. There's a valet service there that was never utilized. Therefore, whatever means was used to get from wherever the plaintiff came with her friends was known to her and her alone. It is undisputed that the keys in this case were provided to the vehicle, were provided by Ms. Grohl to Ms. Reed.
Well, I can only speak for myself here on this first question, though. It has to do with the doorman kicking them out when they asked to stay.
Okay.
And right? It was like people that are arguably helpless or impaired who might get a cab pulled by the fellow in the lobby, get out of here.
Thank you, Your Honor. As it relates to that statement, of course, because of the condition, we don't know if Ms. Grohl did or did not stay to save the hotel. What we do know is that the room was occupied by 11 people. We know that it was occupied by three people who registered to the hotel. It was Ms. Grohl, Ms. Tazel, and a friend of theirs. We know that the occupants of that room involved one stranger to the group completely from California.
I'm not talking about all that. I'm talking about when they're in the hall there, in the lobby, and they're impaired, and one of them says, you know, or intimates, it might even be Grohl herself, we need a cab, they were told to get out on the street.
And I will state the code, I understand the record to be in this case.
Okay.
They were approached by security. I'm not going to go into great detail. I think the briefs spell it out. But they were at, the security people met them in the hotel room. There was dialogue first with one security person. A second security person, a supervisor, came to the room and worked with the occupants of the room. The assistant manager, the manager on duty that night, Mr. Maradiega, came to the room and spoke to the people. We know that, and I'm not suggesting for a minute the police were involved in this, the policeman was on the floor who came up with Mr. Maradiega. They interacted. There was discussion about what would go on. It was unequivocal that the non-registered guests were told they had to leave. What goes on after that is a question of fact to be resolved by a jury who goes back, but what we do know is ultimately they were all asked to leave as it relates to find the facts most favorable to the plaintiff.
Right.
15 minutes transpired, 20 minutes transpired, it's clear from the record. They leave the room fairly slowly. Ms. Reed, who drives the vehicle, comes out first. She's the very first person to see. She's on her cell phone, using the cell phone. She is riding down the escalator in high heels. She goes down to the bottom of the escalator. The record shows this, showing no signs of intoxication. She is followed by several other occupants of the room. While they're downstairs in the lower lobby of the hotel, there's a verbal exchange with one of the two police officers who are on the scene. And there's an exchange about them being asked to leave the hotel and some other facts that they were talking about. The police officer showed no concern about that whatsoever. 15 minutes go by. The record is clear that virtually every one of the occupants in that room has a cell phone. Not only did they have a cell phone, they used a cell phone. They're using the cell phone while they're waiting. They're down there for at least 15 minutes, it's like 16 minutes. Finally, Ms. Grohl comes down. She's got her winter coat on. She's got her bag and nobody's helping her with it. I'm saying nobody in her party's helping her with it. She comes down the escalator with her friend from Arizona. They come down, they're still in the lobby area. They don't ask for any help. When they come out the door, and the record I know shows this, there's a cab sitting there where a man on crutches is being assisted into the cab by a valet from the hotel. They do not speak to the valet. We have one person who said that he talked about a cab, and that's a gentleman who was in shirt sleeves that evening. He's standing up front. We have a photograph of that record. And he points over the cab stand that's always full over at the West. There's no evidence Ms. Grohl asked him to call a cab. There's no evidence that she asked for a cab. And there's no evidence that anyone would climb to get her a cab. They came outside. We know she used her cell phone outside. We know she called her brother. Her brother told her to take a cab. She did not do that. So I understand the court's concern about the eviction.
Did that conversation with the person in the lobby that's employed by the Westin say, get the F out of here, did that happen or didn't it?
That happened outside the hotel on the, in the exterior, outside of the premises. So in other words, they all come down and congregated for 15 minutes. As they all gathered down there, he was following down. I'm not saying, by the way, it's true. I'm just saying it's true according to the statement made by the
We have to accept the facts. I mean, that's one of the facts, isn't it?
That's one of the facts. Okay. And as they all get out the door, they're all outside. They're congregating, deciding what to do. They're talking about what to do. And it's at that juncture that they've left. They're still in the driveway, so they're still on the premises. She does not approach anybody from the hotel. None of her friends do. This one individual was a non-registered guest, as he did, and that's when that statement was made about her. I understand your concern, but there was plenty of opportunity, as the record reflects, as a matter of law, for anybody to call a cab, particularly when you're told to get a cab, and you choose not to get a cab. And that then leads to a series of events that transpires off the premises, down in the parking lot, where they run the barricade to the parking lot. They leave, they're 15 miles away, and they're doing 80 miles an hour. And they had seven people unbelted in the car. So I suggest that based on the record, if I'm a property owner, or if anyone's a property owner, we ask people to leave the property for reasons we know we're legit. And we do not do so in a manner that we know there's imminent danger outside. Or if you're the landowner in Colorado does it, where they don't have reason to believe there's the person's incapacitated, I think you have a legal right to do that. That's what the defendant is arguing. I want to point some things out to the court and lay that question. This isn't just a hotel, although it's couched in terms of a hotel. We all have BYOB parties. We don't serve any alcohol. People were asked to leave. We have, God forbid, the Colorado Symphony recently had a symphony where they celebrated marijuana. They said, we don't want you to smoke marijuana, but marijuana is now the law in this state. We have Red Rocks that hosts up to 9,000 to 10,000 people, where sometimes people are asked to leave. Many miles from Denver, downtown Denver. We have 15 college programs in the state, and at least 5 college football games. And from time to time, people are asked to leave. Practically speaking, it costs far more than season tickets to the Denver Broncos than it does to have a hotel room for a night. And we have 5-6 professional football teams, and I'm probably leaving some out. The Broncos, Nuggets, Avalanche, Rockies, Rapids, and Manly. And on those occasions when people are intoxicated, or worse, they're Raider fans, or some of the people don't agree with in this state, they're asked to leave. And I'm not making light of the situation, but they're asked to leave. It happens routinely. They are never provided a taxi. They are never provided transportation. And they are asked politely to leave. And they may not even be intoxicated. They may not even have a few drinks. And it's the right of the individual or the property owner to do that, so long as there's not imminent danger. I agree with the court, but under the facts of this case, we're not presented with that. I would suggest that I'm presented with that.
Well, counsel, can I get you to maybe address it a little bit? I think your recitation of the facts addresses the facts from the people's perspective, but how about your duty? Can you please describe for me what your duty is with regard to people who stay at Westin?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The Westin is a hotelier, or the Westin is any business owner in the state of Colorado, has a duty to make sure that the occupants, whether they're licensees or invitees, are providing reasonable and safe use of the property while on the property. Where this becomes problematic, that is to say, the legal limitations and legal duties, is when you start moving off the premises. Where it becomes problematic is when you start injecting alcohol into the mix, if you will. And the reason I bring that up is this court started to move against the common law that it had been back in 1986, when it had the two decisions, which was Floyd and Larva. And what it did was it said, we're going to move away from the common law, which was strictly that if you buy the alcohol, you're responsible. And we started to move away from that. The General Assembly responded to that, and the court is well aware of that. And the reason I bring that up is that when the General Assembly responded, it started talking about the circumstances under which one is liable for probably conduct off the premises. And then there's a series of decisions that take place shortly after the enactment of the Crenshaw Act. The first one we have is case Walt versus Collin. There could probably be a more contentious decision was issued by this court, or it's 4-3 or three written opinions, but in that regard, there's a talk about duty. And what the majority found in that case is there was a duty for an incident that happened off the premises if one provided the instrumentality of the injury, that is to say, the alcohol.
Well, maybe we can just take the alcohol out of this. I know you don't want to do that, but the way you're responding to the question, but let's just set the alcohol aside. Just tell me what is the duty, I mean, the common line called innkeeper duty, but maybe you can just describe to me what you think the duty is for the Weston in this situation.
Thank you. As it relates to the duty, if you take the alcohol out of it, and we've thought long and hard about taking the alcohol out of this, let's just say you have people who are acting improperly. You have people that you've asked to leave the premises. They don't have a legal right to be there in the sense that you have an absolute obligation to keep them there when they say, I want to stay. You have a privilege or a license to use the property. And you ask them to leave. You still have to be reasonable when you ask them to leave. You have to be reasonable while they're on your property. But at some point in time, before the reasonableness has to leave, and the question it asks us then is the second thing we address, is the proximate cause, or the cause of the incident in this case. Now, I'm not trying to deflect the court's question. I'm really not. But a landowner has to be responsible for the safety and well-being, not only of people like Ms. Grubb, but everybody that occupies the hotel that night. That's a fact. And the problem with this is you have these dueling duties, and they are duties, to make sure that people who rent the room who don't care to engage in behavior, whatever it may be, have a peaceful night. Then the hotel gives that to people who are trained to make sure the property is safe. And they make sure the property is safe. I'll suggest to the court this. There's an interesting fact in this case that's in the record. We had a lady that night walk into the foyer on the right-hand side of the hotel. She collapsed. She passed out. The hotel called the police. The police got the EMTs there. They checked her out. She left the hotel that night, 5 minutes after the door body did. That's what the record shows. The reason I make that point is the duty is to make sure the person is safe for themselves and to make sure they get off the property safe.
Well, then let's just stop there. What did you do to ensure that the person here got off the property safe?
To make sure the girl and her party got off the property safe?
Yeah, you just said that that was your duty. So tell me what you did to ensure that that was followed through.
What I suggest to the court is that if you make sure that they are, first of all, you can't physically restrain them. You can't do that. Second, you can't force them to do anything. Third, as a property owner, you have to make sure your property is reasonably safe. And that's not just what you're talking about for a duty. And then three, if you ask them to leave, which I believe you have a right to do this, no case law or statute to the contrary, that you have to make sure you leave your property safely. You can't be a guarantor of their safety forever, temporarily or geographically. And this court has said that on more than one occasion in several cases since case law.
Well, so help me understand that. I understand your point that once they are off the property, your argument is that your duty is done, correct? But how about how did you ensure that these people departed the property safely?
Well, they did depart the property safely, Your Honor. And the record is, in this instance, they departed the property safely. Then they went to another piece of real estate where Ms. Gillard parked her car that my client had no control or rent control over, had no knowledge of it, there's no evidence of it. The record is clear on that. And then she went down there, and not only did she not drive her car, but she gave the keys to Ms. Reed. And that was a person with whom my client had no contact whatsoever through the course of the evening whatsoever. She used an escalator, she went up to the room. There's no evidence she spoke to anybody at the hotel.
Many of us have had circumstances where cabs don't come 20 or 25 minutes. What if there are no cabs there You're visibly intoxicated. I'm going to put this back in there. I'm not off the property yet. And the employee of the hotel says, get out of here. You can't wait for the cab. And they decide, well, we've got to drive.
And as I read the court's order for this case, I'd make that assumption as one of the facts in the case, but that's not the facts. There were cabs there. They're just what? They all had phones.
Could I take you back to where Justice Ide was going, I think? We don't quite get there, at least what I was hearing her say. So in terms of duty, you're talking about, you've used terms like ensuring that they get off the property reasonably, in a reasonably safe condition. At one point I thought you said something about without imminent danger. Well, I guess that's what I'd like to get a sense about too, is how would you describe the confines of that duty? And just, you talked about, you know, being a long way down the road, which here it seems to be. A number of things happen in between. It's time, it's distance. Suppose these people had got off the property safely, and while hailing a cab across the street, walked out because they failed to perceive the traffic, either because of their drunken condition or whatever, and got hit. Would you still have a duty there? How do you decide? And I assume you're not saying this is just purely a question of when you break the plane of the door, you're free.
I'm not, Your Honor. I'm saying that if you serve alcohol, see, the problem we have here is that alcohol you can't remove in this case because the alcohol's in the case. I mean, none of this happens. The girl probably drives a car, and she hasn't had a few drinks, and he gives the keys to Reed, who she believes is okay. We don't know that. All we know is that in this state, to move liability off the premises, that is to say, beyond four squares of your property, you have to either create a condition, or you've had to create a problem for the plaintiff where you know that they're going to be subjected to immediate harm. That's what the law has been. And what the legislature said is the one thing we know about is alcohol. We know that because bad things happen with alcohol. In every case that was a science system that talks about duty, talks about it in terms of grandchild and then the expected of grandchild. If my client had given her the car, had known she'd driven there, then you'd have a problem with the duty. But if they don't have that, then you have to presuppose that the people who were working there knew she drove there. And the record doesn't reflect that.
Yeah. So also, let me try to come at this from yet another direction. Normally, when we're thinking about duty, we give that obligation to the judge to determine, as a matter of law, whether or not there is a duty, right? It's not a jury question. It's a question for the judge. And there's been lots and lots of cases which set up an analytical framework by which you have to think about what is a duty or what is not a duty. And the first thing that we start looking at is to try to determine what the risk is. And you seem to be taking the position that there was no risk to this plaintiff when she was outside the doors of the Westin, and that therefore the analysis stops there. Is that not right?
I think that's not right, Your Honor.
Okay, then what was the risk to the plaintiff?
The risk involved is any time one drinks alcohol, there's a risk involved. That just has to be. I'm not saying
she was the worst. The next step where we have to go is given that there's this risk, and everybody knows that when you've been drinking a lot of alcohol, you're maybe not making as good a decision. What is the foreseeability of the injury when you have this kind of an alcohol DUI situation in the making? What is the foreseeability of an injury there?
And I believe that the case law in this court
is what is the foreseeability of an injury, please?
The foreseeability is an accident.
Okay. And then the next step that we have to go to is to weigh that possibility or foreseeability that there's going to be an accident against the conduct of the Westin. Now, the conduct of the Westin here was to kick her out of the hotel, to not let her or her companions come back inside to wait for a taxi, right?
I would disagree with the court. But
all right. How would you define the conduct of the hotel?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
How would you define the conduct of the hotel?
Well, to define the kind of hotel is that they asked her to leave. They asked the group to leave. She left. They interacted with her for the better part of 15 minutes. She's a downtown Denver. She had a phone. She used the phone.
Well, the conduct of the hotel, please. Would you stay focused on that? What was the conduct of the hotel?
I believe that the hotel was civilized, except they say the one guy said nephew. I can't speak to that. He's the investigator.
Well, looking at the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, which we must, one of the doormen not only said nephew, but he said you can't come back in.
That's what
we wait for the taxi. That's so that's the conduct of the hotel that we're looking at, is it not?
Then there are two other tests that I believe the court is concerned with, which is the magnitude of the burden, guarding against the injury, or the consequences of placing the burden upon the injury.
Right.
As it relates to that, this court has moved to where alcohol is involved, and alcohol is involved here, to cases where that has occurred, and what the court has found is that if you serve the alcohol, you're liable. If you serve the alcohol, there's going to be a limit on your exposure. If you don't serve
the alcohol, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I do want to finish with this test.
I'm sorry.
So if we're looking at it as a risk, that is a risk of somebody driving to you and I getting in an accident, versus the conduct of the hotel, which was to kick this person out and not let her wait in the lobby until a taxi could pick her up. And in fact, to do so profanely, it would seem, in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, then why, in fact, would we not put the duty on the hotel to not act that way so as to protect people?
And all I would suggest to the court is I'm not sure what the alternative is. To let them come back in.
But unfortunately, the judge doesn't get to say, I don't get to think about alternatives. The judge simply just has to come up with the duty. And then instruct the jury as to the duty, or find no duty, and dismiss the case. So what is the duty?
I believe the duty, Your Honor, is that you cannot put somebody in immediate harm, and you cannot put someone out where there's no immediate harm, such as a blizzard, where you know that they can't take care of themselves. The case law has spoken to those duties, have spoken about that. If you know somebody that's physically and mentally unable to take care of themselves, which is not the case here, given all the record that we have before the court, you could have some liability. I would just reiterate to this court.
Do you think whether or not you could have some liability is a question for the jury?
I believe, Your Honor, that what we're talking about is whether or not in fulfilling your duty to an occupant of your real estate, in a real estate situation on your property, that you have to make sure they're safe there. And you have to also make sure that they're not going to be in immediate harm if they leave the property.
All right. Thank you.
And the court apparently disagrees.
Counsel, disagreeing or disagreeing, I wanted to know your position.
In the case of Sidman, and the case of Casebolt, and the case of Gilbert, and maybe Drink, on each occasion this court has emphasized the fact that the Dram Shop Act provides an exception to the general rule that consumption of alcohol is the proximate cause of injuries inflicted by an intoxicated person. In Stroud, the court cited Lyons, Charlton, Sidman, Lauder, Floyd, Observatory versus Daly and Cubbage, all of which addressed alcohol. And the court specifically noted that Tamara, who served a drink, is not a virtual insurer of the people on its premises. In this case, as suggested by Justice Bollock in his dissent in Casebolt, it would be anomalous to hold someone who didn't serve a drink unlimitedly liable for an injury that took place 15 miles and about an hour after the vehicle. Thank you. I reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you. Counsel?
May it please the court. My name is John Poore, speaking on behalf of Julian Grove. Alan Schaffner is with me to counsel today. Your Honors, this is a case about a young adult, Julian Grove, who made a responsible choice to secure in advance a safe place to stay the night before spending an evening in downtown Denver with her friends. The Westin, which is operated by the defendant, Westin Operator LLC, advertises its proximity to downtown drinking establishments and suggests that the Westin is a good place to stay for people who have had too much to drink and who are too intoxicated to drive. Groh, who herself worked in the hotel industry, anticipated in advance that she would be too intoxicated to drive after going out with her friends. She therefore secured room with Wesson so that she would not have to worry about finding alternative transportation home. She relied on Wesson to offer a safe place to stay. The Wesson has conceded, for the purposes of the motion for summary judgment, that there was a point in time at which he evicted Roe from the hotel. The eviction occurred after 3 a.m. on March 4th, 2007, so early spring, late winter. Nicholas Vincent, one member of the group, described the weather outside as freezing. And Gro and her friends were not dressed to linger outdoors to wait for a cab. Wesson security personnel, notwithstanding, refused to allow Gro and her friends to remain in the lobby to make arrangements, even though she was not harming or threatening anyone. And instead, when Nicholas Vincent, a member of the group, asked Wesson security guard Nathan Robinson whether Gro and her friends could remain in the lobby to call a taxi, he responded, "No, get the F out of here." Wesson thereby set into motion a chain of events in which it was readily foreseeable that someone in the group would drive while intoxicated. A catastrophic automobile accident, in turn, was a readily foreseeable consequence of the Wesson's choice. And that's exactly what occurred.
Counsel, can I just stop with the facts that you have right there? And help me understand, what should the Wesson have done?
The Wesson, Justice, I thank you for your question. Wesson has in place policies and procedures for how to go about conducting an eviction. And again, I think at the outset, it's important to know, what the Court of Appeals held in this case. The Court of Appeals did not hold, and at this juncture, Gro was not arguing that the Wesson did not have a right to evict on the occasion in question. And so I think we're in agreement at this stage with the Wesson that evicting was okay. The second portion of the Court of Appeals holding was that the Wesson owed a duty to evict reasonably, and Judge Webb, writing for the Court of Appeals, had noted essentially that because of the late hour, because of the temperatures outside, because Wesson personnel were on notice that the members of the group were intoxicated and had nowhere else to go, that they had a responsibility to conduct the eviction safely. As far as recognizing the duty, Gro submits that that's the duty that this court should recognize. In terms of specifically what Wesson had to do in order to meet that duty of reasonable care, there are a couple of things that are very specific. Number one is to help to secure alternative transportation or to at least allow them to remain on the premises for long enough to get alternative transportation.
I really appreciate you suggesting that, because I think what your opponent is going to say is that there's no duty to ensure a cab for every intoxicated guest. Can you respond to that? I mean, how far does that duty go in your mind?
Well, couple of things. First of all, the innkeeper-guest relationship, as this court has repeatedly recognized, is one of the relationships that gives rise to sort of special duty of care to protect guests from a risk of foreseeable harm. And secondarily, I think when you look at the question of the extent of the duty, and in particular the standard of care, the testimony from both Wesson and plaintiff's hotel security experts, not to mention the Wesson's own policies and procedures, are actually fairly specific about what the Wesson should have done. Number one, their policies and procedures indicate that when there is an eviction, that they ought to involve the police. And secondarily, especially if there's an eviction of intoxicated persons, as occurred in this case, secondarily, that they ought to take some measures to try to evaluate whether the evicted person is in a condition to depart the premises safely, and if not, and if there is a foreseeable risk of harm, that they ought to take reasonable measures to try to mitigate against that.
I'm looking for specifics here. Do they need to stand there and speak to each person and ensure that they get in a cab?
Yeah, I mean, Justice, I think that the circumstances, in an eviction case are going to be sufficiently variable. I mean, as counsel for the Wesson pointed out, there are a lot of different scenarios in which a hotel may need to, may find it necessary to evict a guest. And so there's not a single formulaic thing that Groh is asking this court to mandate that hotels do in every instance. But what Groh is asking this court to do is, number one, to recognize that because it is foreseeable that persons departing the premises in an intoxicated state who don't have alternative transportation options available and don't have other places to go that they're knowledgeable about, that they take some measure to try to mitigate that risk.
So, I'm sorry, can I interrupt you just real quickly? Are you suggesting that? Are you disputing the point that your opposing counsel makes that cabs were available?
Yes.
You're saying they were not?
Yes, Justice Marquez, we absolutely are disputing that, and actually I'd like to delve into that a little bit, because the record on that, I think, is quite clear, actually, that there weren't alternative transportation options abundantly available. The Westin suggested in its argument that there was some kind of a conscious choice by Groh and her friends to forego alternative transportation options. However, this is belied by a number of facts in the record. Number one is the surveillance footage of members of the group leaving. And this was submitted to this court in appendix to Groh's opening brief. It was also attached as Exhibit II to Groh's response to the Westin's motion for summary judgment. And it's about a 7-minute piece of footage of the front entrance, and I want to detail specifically what that shows. Approximately 11 seconds in, as counsel for the Westin noted, there's a man on crutches who exits the premises and gets into a cab that clearly was designated for him, and that cab picks him up. 35 seconds in, that cab continued, the man who was on crutches drives away from the premises. A minute 30 in, members of the group begin to head for the garage. And while they're on the way to the garage, off to their left, there is a second out-of-service cab whose light on top indicating that it's in service was not on. After members of the group are already gone and all but two of them are in the garage and the other two are well past this second cab, then its light turns on at 2 minutes and 30 seconds into the footage. Even more important than that, though, multiple members testified that they looked for cabs when they went out front and didn't see any. Robin Ferguson testified that she didn't recall seeing any taxis out front of the hotel at any time. That's in her deposition on page 82, in the record at page 3380. Nicholas Vincent, who had a conversation with Westin Security, testified that he looked for and did not see any cabs when the group left the building. That's in his deposition, page 149, and it's in the record at page 1474. In the surveillance footage, you see Mr. Vincent actually step out and kind of look off to his left for cabs, and you know, he testifies that he didn't see any. So this notion that there were alternative transportation options available that they willingly chose to forego is not substantiated by the record, number one, and number two.
Well, we're in downtown Denver. This isn't Pahanta or somewhere remote where a cab might be less available.
Yeah, Justice Marquez, there's no evidence that they saw or were aware of any specific alternative transportation options. And I, again, want to emphasize also, or that they knew of another destination that they could immediately go and stay inside and shelter. And I also want to emphasize it because I think it's a critical fact that it was awfully cold. There's testimony that it was cold. The surveillance footage makes quite clear that the members of the group were not dressed to be lingering out of these elements. And it's also worth noting, too, that they had just been told by Westin Security in no uncertain terms not to hang around, not to loiter there and wait for a cab. They had to get out of there. So they went to the garage. And furthermore, to the extent that that they may bear some responsibility for their injuries, that's a question for the jury to sort out at trial in terms of apportioning fault. But that doesn't in any way extinguish the duty that the Westin had to take steps to protect them from foreseeable risk.
Well, in assessing the scope of the duty, we're looking at whether this constitutes nonfeasance, and I think it seems to be where Justice Ide was going with her questioning, and I think what opposing counsel was starting to say in response to Chief Justice Rice's questioning is that we go beyond risk and foreseeability and look at the magnitude of the burden against of guarding against the injury or harm, and also the consequences of placing the burden in this instance on the plaintiff. So help me understand why consideration of those factors, if indeed this is nonfeasance, don't militate against the existence of a duty here for the hotel.
Yeah, Justice said, I think there are two parts to that question, you know, and I'd like to sort of address those. Concerning the nonfeasance, misfeasance distinction, and this is spelled out in Groh's answer brief, but I'll reiterate it here. There are several affirmative acts throughout the eviction process of misfeasance that arguably constituted negligence on the part of the Westin. There's obviously, as we focused on the conversation at the doorway where they asked to be allowed to wait for a taxi and were told absolutely no, get out of here. That's one. Number two is that there's also evidence in the record that a second security guard, John Dale, was also verbally abusive and utilized the same expletive in conversation with another member of the group back in the hotel room. And so there's evidence that, you know, this is not a pure non-feasance case in the sense that these guests simply departed the hotel of their own volition while intoxicated and the Westin failed to stop them from leaving. If that were the circumstance, this would be an entirely different case. The Westin forced them to leave and dictated the time in which they would leave. Secondarily, concerning the duty factors, I'll go ahead and run through what, you know, Groh believes to be the proper duty analysis here. The first being the risk involved. It's substantial. This court has recognized on multiple occasions, the caseable decision and many others, that the risk to both the driver and the general public from intoxicated driving is substantial. The second is the foreseeability and likelihood of injury as weighed against the social utility of the actor's conduct. In this case, once again, the potential for serious injury or death, as happened in this case, from intoxicated driving is substantial. More specifically, in this case, Westin Guard Robinson admitted in a statement to investigating officers after the fact, he saw the group head down to the parking garage knowing they were going to the garage. And the inference to be drawn from that is that he knew they were going to have to drive. Thirdly, Robinson, Dale, and other Mara Kiaga, the manager on duty, were all informed as the group was leaving that they were intoxicated and had nowhere else to go. So it was highly foreseeable that somebody in that group was going to drive while intoxicated, and the magnitude of the risk resulting from that was going to be substantial. And weighing against the social utility of the Westin's conduct, once again, Groh is not arguing in this case that the Westin could not evict. The duty that Groh is asking this court to recognize is a duty to do so reasonably, which means taking reasonable measures to guard against the foreseeable risk of harm. That's the duty and basically the standard of care. What exactly that involves in a particular case may vary somewhat, but that's the duty. The magnitude of the burden of guarding against injury or harm.
Before we go there, let me stay with the issue of whether the hotel room should have known how intoxicated they were. Opposing counsel paints a picture of high heels down the escalator, suggesting that there was not visible intoxication, or at least nothing that would cause them to have a duty. You have a different perspective. Tell me more about your perspective.
Certainly, Your Honor. There was testimony from multiple members of the group that they told Westin security personnel, we're all drunk, we're too drunk to drive, we don't have anywhere else to go. Robin Ferguson specifically testified in her deposition, this is the record, at pages 1969 and 70. When they were kicking us out and they were like, it's your last chance, or time's up and you are out of here, we had all said it. We all said it. We are drunk. Like, what do you want us? Where do you want us to go? What do you want us to do? We are all drunk. We have been drinking all night long. That was the whole purpose. The follow-up question was, did you specifically tell him that? He answered, yeah, we were talking to both of them, the two security guards, Robinson and Dale. Jackie Casel, Groh's roommate, also indicated in a statement to an investigating officer in the record at page 2029 that they all told Westin personnel we were drunk as well as in the room. So, you know, to the extent that there's a dispute about those facts, moreover, Groh's entitled to have those at this juncture in motion for some
thank
judgment.
You.
Confirm.
Yeah, Mr. Ford.
Go ahead.
Mr. Ford, specifically, what would you have our holding be with regard to the duty? You've outlined the test. What would you say?
Could you just finish the test before you decide what the holding is? Because you were about to start with the last part of the test, and I'd like to hear your analysis of that.
Yeah, I would like to talk quickly about the magnitude of the burden of guarding against injury or harm. This court in the Health 1B Rodriguez case, and I understand it's a case about nerve block, hearts, and vials, so factually, you know, it's not, you know, an eviction case or anything like that. But this court's analysis in that case recognized the principle that when an actor or when an industry generally has policies and procedures that are designed to guard against a particular risk, that militates against the conclusion that it's burdensome or that it's overly burdensome to ask them to take steps to guard against that risk, because the extent of the burden would essentially be to follow their own policies and procedures. Moreover, in this case, it's obviously up to the jury if this case returns for trial to determine exactly what the West End would have needed to do in order to be reasonable, but at the end of the day, Gross admits that simply allowing them to wait in the lobby for long enough to get a taxi would have satisfied the duty, and the burden of doing that is not substantial. Also, West End has acknowledged that there were police officers on the scene who were there on an unrelated matter. Both of those officers have testified that they were not involved in the eviction. There may have been a very brief interaction with one member of the group. They said, look, we were here on an unrelated matter. We weren't there to deal with them. They were doing their own thing. They had a problem with security. All the lesson would have had to do in this case is involve the officers in the eviction, as their own policies indicate that they should have done. And the officers testified that they would have evaluated whether the group was able to leave safely, and that would have adequately discharged the duty.
Before you get back to Justice Butler's question, what were the procedures that the Westons set out exactly? What were the procedures that the Westons set out?
The procedures concerning noise complaints and evictions were essentially as follows. Number one, to have when there's a noise complaint, I mean, it references noise complaints, but it's undisputed that no other guests ever complained about the group in this instance. To contact the room, provide a warning. If there was a need to return for a second time, asking non-registered guests in the room to leave. On a third need to visit, eviction at that point would become permissible, but needed to be conducted with the involvement of the Denver police. And again, those policies make sense because, number one, it's foreseeable that an eviction, in some cases, not this one, but that it could become contentious, and more importantly, also foreseeable that if you have intoxicated persons departing the premises, that they may not be in a condition to look out for their own safety or to make, you know, good choices about whether or not to operate an automobile. So,
does that make sense of the policies then? The procedures, is that the list? I ask only because it doesn't seem that you are actually contesting the eviction itself. I mean, the fact that the hotel chose to evict, you're not saying that the decision to evict was unlawful.
Right, and then secondarily, thank you, Justice Marquez, the other component of that is when you have an intoxicated guest departing the premises in general, Western witnesses are very clear and the training materials are clear that helping to secure alternative transportation, if it's needed to get guests away from the premises safely, is also one of the procedures that they find themselves to follow.
So, Judy.
So, yeah, go back to Justice Butler's question.
What would the holding?
The holding would be that the Westin owed a duty under the circuit, well, that the Westin in general owes a duty to use reasonable care or to act reasonably in conducting an eviction. That duty is broad enough to include a duty to guard against or to take steps to protect against a foreseeable risk of injury.
The last part of the test under nonfeasance is the consequences of placing the burden on the actor. Can you speak to that part of the analysis?
I think, again, the consequences are not substantial, and again, the reason for that, number one, I think goes back to the burden analysis that, you know, this is simply a matter of industry actors such as the Westin following their own policies and procedures that they've already outlined. And number two, from a public safety standpoint and from the standpoint of the safety of the guests, the consequences are favorable. The bottom line is that that the foreseeable risk and the substantial risk in this case is one of serious injury or death resulting from intoxicated driving. Consequences of placing a burden to evict reasonably on Weston is that it makes the kind of accident that happened in this case less likely. It makes it less likely that hotel guests may be injured after they're evicted. It makes it less likely that other members of the public who may come into contact with them could be injured as a result of the eviction.
Counsel, could you speak to your opposing counsel's argument that evictions take place in many other types of contexts, sporting events, rock concerts, and so on and so forth? Would your proposed rule extend to other contexts, or would you limit it strictly to the hotel setting?
Well, Justice Marquez, what would be necessary in a particular case, again, to discharge a duty of reasonable care would vary somewhat case by case. And what I would submit is that all of those circumstances are pretty dramatically different from the circumstance that's at issue in this case. I mean, in the case of a rock concert, you have, mass sort of, a lot of people present, there's sort of a chaotic environment. There's not really necessarily ability for security to follow up and, find a quiet place to call a cab. What would be necessary to meet a duty would be quite different. Secondarily, in most of the examples that Mr. Walls outlined, that venue would also have been a server of alcohol, which makes the case quite different. And thirdly, again, there's no formulaic way to sort of dictate what a defendant needs to do in a particular case in order to meet a duty of reasonable care. And this court need not try to decide what the defendant would have to do in every single case. In this case, there was a very easy step that the Weston could have taken in order to meet the duty of reasonable care.
But isn't that where the rubber always hits the road, which is that it's the trial judge's duty, responsibility, let me change words, it's the trial judge's responsibility to decide what the duty is. Mm-hmm. And then the jury's responsibility to decide whether the duty has been breached. Mm-hmm. And so, to a certain degree, it's a very hard job for a trial judge because you have to look at the facts which are presented to you and decide whether there is some duty presented by that. And that's why we have this particular test. So it's very important not to look backwards, not to say, I could have done this and this and this and this person wouldn't have been hurt, but only to look forwards. What in this particular situation is the duty? And your answer seemed to me to be looking backwards. So if we were to look forwards, we were to think about other kinds of situations, all of the sporting events your opposing counsel mentioned, how would you determine the duty in that particular situation?
Again, Justice Rice, I think that the broad holding, or the holding that the Court of Appeals reached concerning the duty question is adequate for those purposes. And it's specifically that the eviction, and when it happens, has to be done reasonably. And in this case, when we talk about looking forward or backward, from the standpoint of Weston personnel who were there, looking forward, it was highly foreseeable that they were evicting, on the facts on this record, a group of vulnerable people into conditions in which it was foreseeable that they would suffer an injury. And beyond that, I mean, the recognition is one of the duty of reasonable care. Exactly what the standard of care, whether the defendants acted reasonably, there are a lot of different permutations of possible eviction scenarios that make it difficult to apply a formulaic recitation beyond acting reasonably. But all this court really needs to do is to recognize that there is a duty to evict reasonably, recognize that it extends to foreseeable injuries, even if those injuries may occur off the immediate premises, and recognize that they've got a responsibility.
Does it make any difference if the plaintiff here is the person that rented the room for the shelter for the night to stay there and sleep it off?
Yes, Justice Hobbs, it does, because she is the registered guest of the hotel, and as I noted before, this court's recognized that innkeeper guest is one of the special relationships that gives rise to a duty to protect.
And that is a way to distinguish this case from the idea of a big sporting event where people are turned loose. They're not given habitation for the night.
Yes,
except inadvertently.
Well, certainly, yes. There is, in the sense that this isn't one of those categories of special relationship. I'm not aware, and opposing counsel hasn't cited any case law to indicate that when I go to, I guess it's Sports Authority Field now at Mile High, that I'm in a special relationship with the city and proprietor. It's a different situation, and the bottom line also, because of the way that the Westin markets itself and its location, it does assume a responsibility to provide a safe place to stay. And when an eviction is conducted unreasonably, it doesn't discharge its duty. The other thing that I would point out, because of the special relationship, and going back to Justice Hood's questions earlier about the distinction between misfeasance and nonfeasance, the special relationship can give rise to a duty of reasonable care, even in the absence of active misfeasance by the defendant. Now, that is not this case, because I think the plaintiff's identified several affirmative acts of misfeasance, but that's something also to consider. I'd like to go on briefly and just use the remainder of my time to discuss the proximate cause issue today. Talking about the Grand Shot Act, the second issue in which this court granted certiorari is whether the Court of Appeals erred in failing to apply the Grand Shot Act when finding that summary judgment based on proximate cause was not warranted. As counsel for the Westin correctly noted, this court made some decisions that the General Assembly responded to by enacting the Dram Shop Act, which was essentially a response to lobbying efforts by the liquor industry to try to limit the liability of bars and servers of alcohol. The preamble to the statute, subsection 1, it speaks in terms of proximate cause, but the fundamental objective of the statute is really to limit the liability of vendors of alcoholic beverages by severely capping the damages and imposing a one-year statute of limitations. The irony of that is that in seeking to limit proximate cause, in a way the General Assembly actually expanded it in cases in which the Act actually applies. And specifically, this Court's decision in Building and Enable Drink. This Court held that the statute, where it applies, actually expands proximate cause by sort of removing foreseeability from the proximate cause inquiry. In other words, if the statute applies, if the suit is against a server of alcoholic beverages, injuries that result as a cause and fact of that action are, as a matter of law, caused by the actions of the server of the alcoholic beverage. But it's undisputed in this case, and the Westin mentioned this earlier, Mr. Walls mentioned this earlier, that the Westin didn't serve alcoholic beverages to any of the members of the group. Didn't serve to Jillian Rowe, didn't serve to Angela Reed, didn't serve to anybody else as far as anybody knows. The second thing I wanted to go to is the statutory preamble. And this is all spelled out in brief, so I don't want to belabor it here, but the preamble in subsection 1 speaks in terms of apportioning causation and responsibility for injuries in terms of a dichotomy between servers and consumers of alcohol. It doesn't speak to the liability of third parties who may also bear a share of the legal responsibility for injuries that are occasioned when someone is intoxicated. And this court in the Casebolt case, and also in the Peterson v. Halstead case, recognized that third parties other than server or consumer can bear a share of legal responsibility for injuries that occur when someone is intoxicated. I think it bears mentioning also that those cases were decided in 1992, 22 years ago. In the interim, the General Assembly has amended in various ways, made amendments to the Dram Shop Act. Not once has the General Assembly ever gone back and suggested that, never once has the General Assembly gone back and changed that language in the preamble to suggest actually, no, there are third parties who may also bear a share of legal responsibility under the old rule can't do so anymore. And so to do so in this case and to say that the Court of Appeals should have considered the Dram Shop Act would essentially be substituting or performing a function that's probably more appropriately left to the legislature. And finally, I think I've belabored the point about the foreseeability of the accident in this case enough, but it bears mentioning that all members of the group are heavily intoxicated. There's evidence in the record that their reaction times, ability to operate a motor vehicle, judgment were all severely impaired and that made the accident and the consequences of the accident in this case highly foreseeable. And so Rowan asks this court to affirm the Court of Appeals and begin this case for trial.
All right, thank you, Mr. Poole. Mr. Walsh?
Thank you, Your Honor. Very quickly, in the cases where this court has found to be, such as I'm going to use Whitlock as an example, which is a non-feasance case and evaluates the five concerns that the court needs to be concerned about. When the court found the University of Denver, one of the things they noticed when the university knew the trampoline, they knew it was being used, and at times they instructed them to put it away when it was not being used. So they take affirmative action. The court found the University of Denver, and what it did, what it said was, this was not a relationship of dependence with respect to the activities they issued him, and provides no basis for recognition of duty. That's what the court said in this case. This is a hard case. It's a hard case because the injuries were sustained by Ms. Grove. But in those cases, this court has decided liability that would occur off the premises. On each and every occasion, it dealt with behavior that has been generally described as opprobrious, morally reprehensible, talking about getting in a car to an intoxicated person, talking about over-serving a person, and that too much. In each case where it's moved off the premises, it said that. The court is asked about five concerns. The duties of my client are not only in this role to evict a reasonable if they decide to evict him, but also to all the other occupants of the hotel. And that is one of the social things the court has to take into consideration when describing the duty. It's to the other people who are involved here. It was an employee whose only owner has a room full of, not a room full, 11 people in the room. They know that if they have construction knowledge, three have chosen to be in the room. I'll finish by this.
Well, let me just, I'm sorry, I'm running short on time. Are those duties really mutually exclusive? Why can't you, are those duties really mutually exclusive?
I think they're not hand in glove. I think that the duty, when one looks at a form of duty on a hotelier or anybody that they're going to find liability for an accident off the premises, you have to look at the totality of the duty. Is it foreseeable to take care of that one person? Yes. To do so reasonably? Yes. And to make sure that it's safe off the premises? Yes. As the court has said, and I just had 12 seconds, placing the legal responsibility on consumers of alcoholic beverages as a rational basis in fact, and is rationally related to the legitimate state purpose of preventing alcohol-related damage. That's what we're dealing with here, not only with the Dram Shop Act, but also with respect to prior common law that holds the person who drinks responsible and the proximate cause. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. And I'd like to thank you, Mr. Waltz, and also give the support for your arguments today and your briefing. This case is staying submitted.